This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is John Schaub. John has prospered during three recessions, four tax law changes, and interest rates ranging from 6 to 16% in his 35 years as a real estate investor. His 2005 best-selling book, Building Wealth One House at a Time, assisted more than 100,000 real estate enthusiasts on their way to a successful investing. John recommends buying better, well-located houses rather than cheap houses and other management-intensive properties. John buys and manages his own properties. He teaches Building Wealth One House at a Time seminars each year, where students learn how to identify the best investment properties in their town. John also invests his time for those cannot afford to buy their own home. He works with Habitat for Humanity and Fuller Center for Housing. And last year, we honored him for his reputation in our industry with the Roney Award. So, John, we really welcome you to our show.
Well, thank you. I'm very, very happy to be here.
I'm just curious, did you ever have a career outside of real estate?
Not unless you count dishwashing a career. When I was a kid, you know, in high school and junior college, I would work in kitchens a lot, and I liked it. I like working in kitchens. I like to cook, and, you know, you'd always start off washing dishes, and you work your way up to fry cook, and then by the third week, you're the assistant manager because nobody else was there after 3 weeks. And so perseverance. I learned perseverance early on, but that was hard work, and I learned that I didn't want to do that when I grew up. You know, that was kid work, not old man work. But I got involved in real estate while I was in college. I managed an apartment building while I was a senior in college, and I actually sold the apartment building, collected a pretty nice commission. That's when I started flying. That's when I got my pilot's license, and the rest is history. I've been in real estate ever since.
What year did you graduate college?
1970.
1970. Okay. So I graduated high school in 1970. So you've been at it for longer than 35 years then.
Yeah. And I've actually added a recession and a tax law change.
Okay. Yeah. I was going to say we need to update that thing. Any early mentors? I don't know who was teaching.
Early mentors. Yeah. I got really lucky early on. First couple of years I was in business, I was selling lots for a company out of Kansas City who had a big subdivision here in the area, and I sold a whole bunch of lots because the early 70s were a hot real estate market, sort of like now. So we sold out a lot faster than we thought, and I flew out, they flew me back to Kansas City, and we'd have meetings, and one of our meetings as we were wrapping up this subdivision, I said, what are we going to do next?
Mm-hmm.
And the guy who owned the company said, you're a salesman. You're not a family member. You know, you're done. So I went home and thought about that, and we had 16 lots left in that subdivision. So I called him back up and said, I'd like to buy those 16 lots from him. And they sold them to me.
Wow.
And I made about as much money off of those 16 lots because I sold them off over the next 2 or 3 years because prices were going up. That I did, you know, on commissions, selling the first 100 lots or whatever it was. So I got into the business there, and then we had a recession in the mid-70s here, and then we had the big inflation of the late 70s and early 80s under Carter and Reagan. And so, you know, I've been through a lot of different kinds of markets, which have been very instructive. I was really lucky to meet a guy by the name of Warren Harding back in, I think, about 1972, and I took his class in 1973. And then I took a couple other classes right in that same time period from people who are not in business anymore. But they were really instructive, and they got me thinking outside the box. You know, before that, I was taking the CCIM classes that the Realtors Institute taught. And they taught you how to do 10-year projections and how to manage your clients' money. And I didn't have any clients. I had a hard time figuring that out. But what I did learn is 10-year projections didn't work. We were doing 10-year projections in 1973 with 7% interest rates, and none of those panned out. You know, every one of them was wrong. So it's funny what you learn. You know, sometimes you learn things you don't think you learn. I learned not to project 10 years. You don't know what the world's going to do. You just have to make the deal you make today works, and protect yourself as much as you can.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a very wise philosophy. When did you get interested into the buy and hold model versus the flipping model? And I'm assuming that's what you concentrated on.
Yeah, you know, early on, you do anything you can to put food on the table. So, you know, I funny enough, the first house I bought to flip, I bought in 1973, and I still have it. I'm not a very good flipper, I don't think.
Is that because it didn't sell? I mean, because I've had some rentals that were definitely in the category of that.
Well, it was a house that had a tenant in it, and I figured when a tenant moved out, I'd sell it, and the tenant stayed there 10 years.
Okay.
So it didn't move. And but funny enough, that house has made me more money than any other house I ever bought because the loan is so long. You know, it's been it had a 20-year loan on it, so the loan's been paid off for more than 20 years now. And you know, the rate of return on your money is pretty phenomenal when you buy a house with a low down payment and you hold on to it forever.
Yeah,
the percentage is nobody believes the percentage, but it's a big number. You know, it's terrific. So what I learned from that is because I was buying and selling, I bought an apartment building, I sold it, I bought a motel and I sold it, I bought a commercial building, had a restaurant in it, I sold it. So, you know, I wasn't in the buy sell business like you were, where I was flipping houses, but I would buy anything I could that I thought I could make a profit on. But when I got into the house business, I never was a flipper in the house business. I really was a buy and hold guy from day one. I bought some when we had recessions. I would buy a lot. You know, when we had the recession of the early 80s, I bought 16 from one builder, 13 from another. So we would load up during the recessions. And then during really boom periods like we're having today again, you know, I don't buy as much. I'm kind of waiting for the next recession because, I don't sell much during the high period, but, you know, you just don't buy as much unless I'm just falling in your lap. I'm always open to a deal. But I'm not out pounding the streets trying to buy 10 or 15 houses this year.
The builders, the inventory that you bought, I'm just curious, how were those financed in those days?
They both of them had institutional loans on them. And the institutions didn't want these houses. The builder didn't want the houses. The institutions thought the builders would file bankruptcy on them. So I was able to get in the middle and do something the builder wouldn't do.
Okay.
I would rent the house. I'd rent the house. The builder wouldn't rent it. So I go to the lender and say, look, I can rent these houses. I can have this much cash flow. I can make you payments of this amount. If you'll modify your loans so that I can afford to own them, you don't have to go on title. You don't have to own all these houses. And, you know, and during these downturns, the lenders don't want more inventory. They have all they want. So you can make better deals, of course, during the downturns than you can in a hot market.
So these were all new homes that you kept as rentals, or did you flip them?
Still have a lot of them. Still have a lot of them.
You still have a lot of them. Wow, okay. Yeah, talk about good rental inventory.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Some of them were, like there was four in a row on one street, and I don't like having four in a row because it starts to look like a duplex to me, you know. So I would sell off every other one, so I'd have own one, sell one. And that's the way we paid off some of that debt because it wasn't cheap debt. You know, you remember the early 80s, it wasn't cheap.
No.
So we were paying high interest, and we wanted to get out of that high interest debt. So we did a couple of things, and that was one pay off some of that debt.
When I got started as a real estate investor, it was 1980. At the end of 1980, I refinanced a free and clear house at 17.5% interest to invest in real estate. So, yeah, I'm familiar with that high number.
And people today just don't have that perspective. You know, I think most people today think if interest rates go up to 10 or 12%, the market will just fall off a cliff and die and nobody ever buy real estate again. And you and I both know that's not true because there is a market at 10 and 12 or 14%. You know, I must say it's wise to borrow at those rates or even to buy at those times, but there is a market. And with rates going up again, we may see double-digit rates again in our lifetime. We'll see.
Yeah, you know, I remember people telling me that you'll never see single digits again.
I mean,
and they were pretty knowledgeable people, you know, and they were thinking, you know, you're never going to get below 10 because we were hovering at 15 and then it would get on sale at 13. You'd think, oh, wow, that's really great. So
yeah.
It is an interesting perspective because you probably have buyers right now hesitating at 4.5, like, oh, I don't know, man.
Yeah, and the kids getting into the business today and into the market today, I mean, it's funny to watch it because they're buying houses they really shouldn't buy because they're buying monster houses because they can afford to buy a $700,000 house with a 4% loan on it.
That's right, yeah.
That's still a big number, that $700,000. You've got to pay that back someday. So,
what's been the source of most of your deals?
Well, the last time I sat down and figured that out, and it's been a few years, about half of my deals came through brokers. Those big packages from the builders, those came through brokers. You know, the brokers had them listed, and they would sell them to me, and we were able to make a pretty good deal on commission because there was a big volume involved. But some of the best deals I've ever made have come through real estate brokers, and generally in the down part of a cycle where they couldn't buy it themselves. And, you know, and you know a lot of brokers. Many brokers don't buy property.
Correct.
They're just simply act as agents. So even when it's a killer deal, they sell it to somebody else rather than buy it themselves. So I try to get to know the agents in my town who are pretty smart, and that means they've been around for a while. You know, most of them have been in business 10 or 20 years, and they know who I am, and they know what I buy, and they know the advantage of selling to me is if they show me something and it's really a good deal, I'll buy it. So they'll get a commission, and they'll get two shares of the commission if they've got it listed. So I try to deal with people who list a lot and say, look, when you list something and you know the people want to sell it right away and they'll take a low price, call me. I'm not emotional. I can make a decision in one day, and we can close the same week or however as fast as you can get the paperwork done. Because we got the money in the bank, or I know where I can get the money. So a lot of our good deals have come through brokers. Now, a lot of them have come because I found a deal. You know, I've driven down the street, and the guy's loading the truck up, and I stop and talk to him and buy his house. So there's as many of those stories as there are of the broker stories, but it's some of each. I have never been a big direct nail person, because I've never bought that kind of volume. You know, my volume has been, on a typical year, 3 or 4 or 5 properties. That's just what I buy. And, you know, these extraordinary years where people are just giving things away, sometimes I'll buy 15 or 20. But typically, I'm buying 4 or 5 houses a year, putting together 4 or 5 deals a year. So I don't need the volume of incoming calls that you get by mailing out 10,000 pieces of mail a month. But I know, you know people, and I know people that do that very effectively, and it's a good way to run a business, but that's not my business. That's not what I do.
You know, I think that's interesting that, you know, your title of your book sort of lent me that to that opinion. You know, when we talk about buying one house at a time, it sounds doable, you know, and that's, I think that's probably what that book did, was encourage people that maybe weren't even in the industry to think, yeah, I could buy one or two a year and do this plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think most people that take my class, and probably a lot of them that read the book, and we rewrote the book, and it's sort of a 2016 edition out now, second edition out on the shelves now, because, you know, we had a little excitement between 2006 and 2016, so I updated the book a little bit for that excitement. But I think most of the people that buy my book, and what I encourage them to do is to buy one house at a time, you know, and maybe they only buy 3 or 4 houses, but to a lot of people, you know, if you're a school teacher and you buy 3 or 4 houses and get them paid off and you retire, you're going to get more money from your real estate than you will from your retirement plan. So a lot of folks will buy just a little bit, and it helps them a lot. You know, they don't need to go out and buy 50 houses. 1 or 2 or 3 may be just perfect for them.
What's a preferable attribute of a good rental property?
Well, I always think about who's going to move into this house before I buy it. And you can pretty well tell who's going to move into that house by looking at the neighbors, looking across the street and driving up and down the street. Or I like to walk through the neighborhood. I mean, I'm not a shy guy. If I see somebody walking down the street, I'll say hi to them, try to strike up a conversation, ask them how long they've lived here, and, you know, learn as much as I can about the neighborhood. But, you know, you can tell by who lives there now, the type of neighbor or type of tenant you're going to attract, I think, when you rent that house. So make sure you like them. You know, make sure that you're comfortable in the neighborhood, and if you're afraid to talk to the neighbors, that's probably a bad sign.
Okay.
You're intimidated by being in that neighborhood, that's a bad sign. So you have to be comfortable. And then, you know, my other rule of thumb is I've never bought a house that I wouldn't move into myself. So I've never bought a house on a real busy street or a scary neighborhood or a real loud neighborhood or a neighborhood didn't smell good. You know, so it's just common sense. A lot of it is just common sense. So if you kind of think about those two things before you make an offer, you know, what kind of tenant you're going to have, and then you can kind of back into how much money they're going to make, and because you can see what kind of cars they drive and what kind of work they do, and you know about how much rent you're going to collect on that house, and that helps you make an offer with mortgage payments each month that you can afford. If you think through it before you buy it, then you don't buy something that's going to cost you money or going to put you under pressure to sell it or to rent it for too much money. You know, we try to rent our properties to people who have, you know, pretty high quality income. They may not have a lot of income, but it's high quality. Whatever they do is steady. You know, it's going to come in every month. And those are the tenants I'm looking for. I'm not looking for the hotshot salesman who might make $5,000 one month and nothing the next month. You know, I'd rather have a nice, steady $4,000 a month or whatever it would be.
These preferable properties are usually in a little bit more expensive areas. Do you see your student base getting to those properties after some other areas that go up? In other words, is there a process to get to those properties? I know you've had an evolution of what you ended up with holding, you know, that it is a premium property. When people are starting, are they better off starting with something that's a struggle to get the equity to get to the neighborhood, or you just prefer don't even go there, don't go to the struggle property? It's not worth the effort?
No, it's probably worth the education if it's not worth the effort. I mean, it was probably, if you think apartment buildings or duplexes or have more cash flow, you should buy one and test that theory. you know, what I have found over the years, and this is no secret, but that you get more gross income from some properties. Like my motel had a lot of gross income, but net income after paying all the expenses and paying the managers and everything else wasn't that high. And so a lot of these properties like duplexes or apartment buildings have higher gross income. But until you own one, you don't realize that your expenses are higher too, because many times people don't take very good care of your property, which means you have higher maintenance. Many times they don't stay very longer, which means you have higher vacancy and more advertising costs. And here's the one thing that's most important to me. It takes more time to manage those properties. And the most valuable asset I have is my time. And I passed up a lot of deals that were very lucrative because it was going to take a lot of my time. So I'm very sensitive to that. So I can buy a house and put a tenant in there, and my average tenant stays pretty close to 10 years, and know that that's not going to take a whole bunch of my time.
Right.
It'll take me some time to find that tenant, and if it turns out to be a bad tenant, I'll have to get involved and kick them out or talk them into paying a rent on time. But you know, I'd say 90% of my tenants are what I call good tenants. They take very, very little bit of my time, and there's always that 10% that are going to, you know, be a little higher maintenance one way or the other. But it's a pretty low maintenance business as far as my time requirements go. So I see the houses as more of a true investment than I do apartment buildings or motels or commercial buildings, which are really businesses. They're kind of pseudo investments, but they're businesses. You have to stay right on top of them. The air conditioner breaks in the dentist office, you can't fix that 2 weeks later. You need to get on that right now because they're losing patients.
So right.
It's a different game. I've
been asked, you know, why didn't I invest in apartment buildings? And I said, you know what it comes down to is I don't want to live there myself. My whole goal, if I was in an apartment, would be to leave. And I just think, I don't want to have 100 of those people in one place thinking, I can't wait till I get out.
That's good logic.
Yeah, I guess it was. You explained it. As you were explaining, I was thinking, yeah, that's exactly why I don't own that stuff. Property management, you do it yourself.
I do. I manage all my own property, and I've tried different things. I've tried having other people manage for me, but I am so good at it, and I am so efficient at it. And I teach a class on landlording. I mean, it's not rocket science. It's just common sense business. But if you select the right people and you give them some financial incentives to do the right things, and the right things are to pay on time and take care of their house, then you know the management is not that hard. So when I delegate to somebody else, what I find is they rent to the wrong people. You know, they're not as selective as I am. I'll let a house sit empty a couple of months if I have to find the right tenant. I am not in a hurry to rent a house. And that's probably the biggest mistake a new investor makes is when they buy that first house, they at some point get kind of anxious to rent it. So they may rent it to the wrong person, you know, because they're in a hurry. But I tell people to have at least a couple of months rent in the bank, you know, before you buy a house. So after you buy it, just say, okay, here's the first 2 months payments. I don't have to rent it for 2 months if I don't find the right person. And then hopefully within a couple of months, you will find the right person. And I think you will in most markets if you work at it. You know, you need to interview a few. But you know, sometimes I turn down 5 or 10 people before I rent a house.
I certainly found that well-located properties are really drivers of very good quality people. In Riverside, as a matter of fact, this is how off I was on rents. I am typically never raising rents. And the last time I had rented this property, it was $1,300. And then I had a relative live in it for a few years. And I didn't know what the rental market had done. And I did hire a friend of mine that I work out with as a manager. And it's $2,000 now. And I would have never thought that. And it got rented in a few hours.
And it was like, well, it's easy to do. Rents, you know, if you have a tenant that's taking care of a property, it's easy just to go to sleep and just leave them alone. But that does cost you money. So we discipline ourselves to raise our rent once a year. And, you know, we we can negotiate how much we want to raise our rents based on the tenant's performance. If they've been great tenants, we probably won't raise the rents a whole bunch. But if we don't like them much, we'll raise the rents a lot. They'll move out. And I know I can rent it to somebody else for more money, you know. So that's another advantage of having houses over like a 10-unit apartment building. You know, you couldn't do that in an apartment building. You couldn't charge apartment number one $600 a month, apartment number two $1,200 a month and get away with it. They don't talk to each other. You'd have problems.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. I have a street full of rentals in Florida, and I guess that's a possibility that people could talk to each other.
Well, some of them will get to know each other. Well, and in today's world where you can look people up on the internet, and if they see ABC Realty owns all seven houses, then they'll see there's some commonality of ownership there.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons I'm taking your weekend class. I'm going to learn about taking title.
Okay.
Under a different hat.
To talk about that. Well, especially Florida. I mean, I'm glad you're coming to Florida to take a class because, you know, it's a little bit different environment than California, different laws and everything else. So you'll pick up a lot in a couple of days.
Yeah, no, I'm really looking forward to it. The eviction process, actually, in California, it can be crazy. So approximately how long is the eviction process in Florida?
I can do it in 30 days if everything goes exactly right. But you know, you might as well figure 2 months because sometimes things slow down. But you have to be good at it. You know, you have to get in a 3-day, have the right dates on it. Then you've got to file on the date that you can, and then you've got to follow through. So I mean, most people can't do it in 30 days. But if you did everything right, you could have them out in a month. Now I will tell you, in with over 1,000 tenants and 40 years of landlording, I've only evicted 6 people. I haven't evicted somebody in probably 10 years. And the reason for that is if I have a problem tenant, I have found that it's just cheaper to buy them out. And I don't care if I have to write them a $3,000 check. It's cheaper to buy them out than just go through the eviction process.
Okay.
And it's not an emotional thing. It's not a religious thing. It's just cheaper. It's just better business. You know, because if you evict somebody, you lose at least 1 month's rent, maybe 2 months' rent, then they tear the place up when they leave. And so now you may have a $5,000 or $10,000 problem on your hands. And if you're going to write them a check and have them move out this weekend, and typically the reason they're not moving is they don't have any money. So they probably won't have any money in 2 months either when you finally get them out of there. You might as well just get rid of them now, because now then you can fix the house back up and rent it. You know, and maybe recover some of your rent.
When I started having Florida properties, there's a new type of insurance that I haven't had to deal with. That's called hurricane.
There you go, wind insurance.
Yeah, is that like mandatory for when you talk to investors? Is that just something you got to have in Florida?
You have to have it if you have institutional loans, because they require it.
No,
I
mean,
if you don't have institutional loans, you don't have that.
Well, but I mean, common sense. I mean, is that there would be no way?
Oh, if you're free and clear, you mean? If you didn't have a loan or you didn't have? No, I don't carry wind insurance on most of my properties. I don't carry wind or flood. I don't carry flood on anything.
Really?
And we have a lot of waterfront stuff. We don't carry flood on any of it because I've been here all my life. I've got the advantage of being here. And you know, you've been in Riverside a long time. I don't know, but maybe the parallel is earthquake insurance in Riverside. You know, I don't know.
Which I don't have. But you're right.
There you go. But you know, it just doesn't happen very often. We haven't had the last bad storm we had in this town was 1961, and before that was in the 20s. So if you do the math, that's about every 40 or 50 years you get a storm through.
So you're overdue.
It's not worth insurance for. You sound like an insurance salesman. But it just, you know, it statistically doesn't happen that often. And just my own houses that I've owned for well over 40 years now, and they're sitting 3 feet above the water level out on the beach, and they've never flooded, never had a wind problem. So why should I carry insurance for 40 years? I mean, because it's expensive. The flood and the wind insurance on my little house on the beach, that first one I bought, would probably cost me $5,000 a year. So multiply 40 times 5 and see what you get.
Yeah.
That's the wrong number for nothing happening.
That's interesting. Yeah, maybe we ought to be in the insurance business. The heck with all this loans.
I seriously thought about starting an insurance company. You know, I think a well-run insurance company, somebody who could really assess from a practical standpoint the risk on some of these things, could make just a ton of money. But I'm too lazy to do that now. But if I was half my age, I would certainly do it. And I'm going to maybe encourage my kids to do it, because I think it's a terrific business. Because they lay off, you know, they sell, they reinsure, they lay off the high risk stuff, they just keep the safe stuff. They're smart.
Hey, this is Aaron Norris with the Norris Group. If you want more information on John Schaub and to find out more information on the seminar coming up in Florida, May 5th and 6th, you can check out johnschaub.com. If you want to catch us with Stay Put or Cash Out in Southern California, we'll be doing it three times in the month of May. May 9th will be at the OCRE Forum in Santa Ana. May 5th, we'll be doing the Apartment Owners Association Million Dollar Trade Show and Landlording Conference in Long Beach. And finally, we'll be doing Homevestors in Burbank, California. That's Stay Put and Cash Out. And you can find out all of our upcoming events on thenorrisgroup.com.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.